Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight I have Timothy Renner as my guest, and we're going to be talking about his book, Bigfoot in Pennsylvania, which I enjoyed quite a bit. I highly recommend it, and you'll see why when we get into the interview. I have a few shows backlogged that I'm going to be putting up very soon, hopefully all this week, maybe over the next couple of weeks. Just fell a little behind in posting some stuff. Also, I want to give a quick shout-out to Tim Brown from Hawaii, who yelled at me from the balcony outside the radio station last week, and that was pretty cool, actually. So, hey, Tim, there's your shout-out. And also a thank you to all our patrons, and you can become a patron for only $3 a month at wheredidtheroadgo.com. I got some cool stuff coming up for patrons as well. And without any further ado, let's get right into this conversation with Tim. So, welcome to back to the show, Mr. Timothy Renner.
Happy to be here.
And you have this cool new book out called Bigfoot in Pennsylvania. And when did you release this?
Oh, my goodness. it would have been in May of 2017.
Okay. So, not super long ago.
No.
Okay. So, this is... Tell people a little bit about what this is.
Well, the sort of genesis for this book came when I was writing my first book, Beyond the Seventh Gate. And I was trying to track down as many Bigfoot sightings as I could, not just Bigfoot sightings, but, you know, all kinds of strangeness. But, you know, Bigfoot was part of that. And that was just for three counties in Pennsylvania. But as I was doing the research, going back, I found these old newspaper articles, which were, I thought they were really neat, mentioning, not by name, Bigfoot, because Bigfoot as a name really doesn't get really into common usage probably until the 1970s. Out in California, was it Jerry Crew at the construction site coined the term, I think, in the late 50s, but I don't think it was really in common usage as far as, you know, everyone knew what you were talking about when you said Bigfoot until maybe the late 60s or early 70s.
Right.
So, you know, I was finding these articles about wild men and gorillas and hairy monsters and stuff that obviously they were talking about Bigfoot just by a different name. And I found them, you know, for places outside of the area I was writing about in the first book. So I started making a file of these things and by state. I thought, oh, wouldn't it be neat to make a collection of these reports, you know, a whole book full of them. But I went back after the first book was, you know, after I'd done the first book, I thought, well, I'll start, you know, collecting these things, these reports. Well, very shortly into my research, I realized I was going to have enough to do a whole book just on Pennsylvania. So I sort of buckled down and then I just really went after Pennsylvania reports. Till I had enough to fill up a whole book. So these are all reports from the 1800s. The first one, I think, is in, from the 1830s on up to 1922, which is where public domain ends. So I had to stop there. I had enough for a whole book.
Were you able to search these on the internet?
I do internet searches through various newspaper archives. Since this was Pennsylvania, I was able to actually physically go to some historical societies and libraries and do research on microfilm, old school stuff. So I'll do anything, and if it's available to me, I'll go there and go to the places and do that. I love research, so I have no problem putting my nose in microfilm for hours at a time.
How much of this stuff came from microfilm? How much off the internet? Like roughly.
Yeah, probably at least 95 from electronic searches, either internet or other databases.
It seems like that would be easier if you know what terms you're looking for.
It's much easier, yeah. But you know, you can turn up stuff. It's worth doing. For me, it's worth doing as much research as I can. I'm a completist. I like to get things as close to complete as possible.
And one of the things you did in here, you say right off the beginning, is you didn't really change any of the articles to make them politically correct or anything like that. And that includes some borderline racist comments here and there.
I'd say outright racist comments.
I was actually expecting it to be a lot worse, honestly.
Yeah, yeah. In general, it's pretty good. There are a few articles that are definitely make you cringe when you read them.
But I really expected it to be more racist than it turned out to be. I mean, in some cases, it's just them using terminology that is now not politically correct, but it was at the time.
Right. Yeah, and here and there, you just get some outright racism, xenophobia. It's all, you know, it's all tucked in there. It was a different world back then.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the interesting things when you read these articles as they are, is that you get that feel of how different things were, how different people approached things and viewed the world in general.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's definitely a window into the past.
And some of the theories that people come up with on this are just, they're on par with the quality of theories people come up with now, especially the more skeptical ones.
Well, that's the thing that amazed me, that not only if you're into Bigfoot, these reports will be very familiar in a lot of ways. The behavior that they're describing is very familiar to modern reports, but also the behavior and the attitude of the skeptics is very similar to like the modern hard skeptic who's just willing to deny everything. It's really interesting.
I think my favorite was the hair tonic one.
Oh yeah, that's great.
which the explanation for the wild man is he must have used so-and-so's hair tonic and it worked really well.
I think it was Dr. Jane's hair tonic. Yeah. And you can't tell from the article whether it's, you know, and it seems like it's a legitimate article, and then it takes this shift at the end to like, oh, you know, certainly this fellow fell into a bottle of Dr. Jane's hair tonic or something like that. And you don't know if it's like, all right, is this like now an ad? Is this, you know, paid content back in the 1800s or what's going on here?
There's also the ridicule factor is intact there too.
Yes.
Them of course accusing people of being drunk or, you know, insane, and actually the attitude, not so much just the attitude, like the way that some of these people think things work, you know, it's like, oh, this is clearly a man who was spurned by his lover and went insane and went out into the woods and is now a wild man. And it's like, what?
Yeah, well, it's right on the heels of Darwin, too. So you have this, I think it's people sort of misunderstanding Darwinism. Like, they think, like, okay, there's even a couple of mentions of Darwin in the articles. Like, okay, this guy, he left society, he went out and he became wild, so he must grow hair, you know, like an animal, because he left society. It's a very different way of thinking. I think it's sort of logical, I guess, if you really don't understand the way Darwinism works.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like it, you know, a lot of it's just on the heels of Darwin's theory of evolution, and people just sort of not quite grasping it.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. But it does give you that sense of like how different people thought at the time.
Oh yeah, yeah.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I just there's a naivety of science, I suppose, there. And I don't know if you can blame it, you know, on them not knowing. I think it's just the time, you know.
Yeah,
they just
didn't have the understanding of it that we do today. And there's still people who don't have a good understanding of science, who are out there spouting crazy theories, and you're looking, you're like, you don't understand what you're talking about.
Right. Oh, yeah. There's still people who truly think that Darwin said that we came from monkeys.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a great example, because, I mean, where you have that whole argument where they don't understand that it's a similar family tree to monkeys, not that we literally evolved from monkeys.
Right. Exactly.
So as we go through this, the first section you had about the Albet witches.
Albatwitches. Yeah.
You know, I don't know if there's a right pronunciation. I even in Pennsylvania, even locally, where they are supposedly from, I get Albatwitch and Albatwitch. So take your pick.
It looks like Albatwitch to me.
And again, it's about 50-50 on the pronunciation of people around here. So
tell us a little about them and like the whistling that seems kind of unique to them.
Albatwitch is a local name for a creature that seems to pop up all over the country by different names. In the north, I think the in New England, they call them Pukwudgies.
Mm.
Megamoesus, other places on the East Coast. And just in Pennsylvania, we've called them the Albatwitch. And that is, to the best of my abilities, it's a German compound word. Alb is German for elf. And there's a German verb, entwinchen, which means to escape. So I think it means like a quickly escaping elf.
Huh.
As a descriptor for these things. So they're small sort of ape men. A lot of people call them little Bigfoot. Some people say they're just young Bigfoot, but they're never seen with adults, and they don't seem to exhibit the same kind of behavior across the board. So I think my guess is that they're different. We're talking about a different creature.
Right.
So they're known for whistling. They're known for, some people say their whistles are to draw people out in the woods. And of course you have this theme again and again where people are drawn out in the woods and never to be seen again. So some people say it's that. Some people say there's a local folklore I turned up just recently that said that they have something called a welcome whistle. And if you learn this complex series of whistles, you can actually call them out because that's their sort of welcome whistle that they whistle to each other. And if you go to places where they are and learn this, you know, this whistle, you can call the creatures out. I've yet to find someone to be able to teach me the welcome whistle.
Now, do Pukwudgies and stuff whistle?
The Megamoesus do. I know they were said to use flutes even.
Hmm.
I'm not sure with the Pukwudgies. I would imagine if you dig deep enough, you'll find some whistling with them.
Interesting. I never thought to connect them to Pukwudgies.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there's, in general, you know, known as the little people, and they seem like they pop up everywhere. They're not common at all, even in terms of these things. I always give people an example. In my first book, I turned up 50 to 70, I think, some Bigfoot sightings in the three counties in Pennsylvania I was talking about. And I think I had maybe 5 Albatwitch sightings in that book. So just, I mean, you take how rare a Bigfoot sighting is, and then, you know, these are that much rarer. So.
Hmm. Okay. And here, these are some of the earliest accounts that you have the Albatwitches on.
Yeah. In fact, the earliest one in the book is apparently an Albatwitch.
Now, one of the things I've noticed, I pick up a lot of connections to David Politis's Missing 411 stuff with some of these accounts.
Yeah, yeah. There's one that reads like a Missing 411 case, really.
Well, there's the one with a wild woman kidnapping a child, and
yeah.
the child is left with just some scratches on it, and that makes me think of David saying, you know, a lot of these kids, when they're found, they're okay, but, you know, they oftentimes have scratches and stuff on them.
Yeah, and that one, I think the mother heard her child screaming. This wild woman had been lurking around for some days, and she took off after it. She actually saw it carrying her child, and she took off after it, and she started screaming. And then I guess her husband heard her and her daughter screaming and chased after him. And finally, this wild woman, as they call her, dropped the child.
And of course, left the scratches, which is one of the features.
So that, yeah.
So that's interesting. And a lot of these people are seeing these things while berry picking, which is one of the things that David had commented on early on. But I'm reading these and I'm thinking, is that really a factor, or is it just that's why people are in the woods in olden days more You know, now that people are more likely to be out there hunting than picking berries, but back then it seems like the berry picking was a very big deal.
Yeah, and I mean, if we're talking about creatures that have to eat, they're likely going to be around berry patches too. When they're in season, things that eat berries will be around berries.
True, true. But I'm just wondering if the berry picking is really a factor, or if it's just that that's where people are and that's where these things might be. You know, like it has not. I guess I'm not really explaining myself very well.
No, I'd say the latter. I think it's not the action of berry picking, and it's not berries. It's just that people happen to be berry picking. I think I get your meaning. That's why they're out there. They happen to be berry picking, and that's when they see the things.
Right, and whereas berry picking's not quite as big of a deal now, you don't get as many people seeing these things or disappearing while berry picking.
Right, right. You do, however, get a lot of Bigfoot reports still when people are picking berries.
Hmm.
So, that continues on to this day. Again, if these things need to eat and the berries are ripe, that's where they're going to be.
And one of the explanations for some of these accounts is that some of these people owning the fields were creating these accounts to scare people away from coming in and stealing their berries.
Yeah, there were quite a few of those. A similar one for a guy who had a Christmas tree farm.
Mm-hmm.
They said he created the story to keep people from coming in and cutting down his Christmas trees, which I thought was especially funny because there's a report around the same time, I mean, within a couple weeks of that, about how all these wild man reports have the Christmas tree sales way down.
Yeah.
So if that's the case, he shot himself in the foot.
Yeah, because no one wanted to go out and cut any Christmas trees, including the people selling them, not just random individuals going out and cutting them.
Right. Yeah.
Let's see. You have a couple of cases in here in the main part of the book that are sort of like paranormal Bigfoot. You got things like them gliding ghostly. There's one where he kind of like slips into the guy's house and he lays down on the bed and then he kind of glides out the window. But later he picks up a gun and shoots at the guy.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really strange one. And some of the accounts, let me take a step back and say, when they call them wild men, sometimes they really are talking about a human, either actual feral human or someone who's homeless or maybe crazy or just otherwise has been mistaken for a wild man. So they call him wild man. So anyone I could tell 100% for sure was a human, I would not put in the book. So there were definitely probably for every one report I thought that is probably or could be a Bigfoot, I threw out 15 or 20 that were definitely humans.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just I took everything, every mention of, you know, wild man and threw it in there. But some of these stories were so weird that I thought, well, even if this is a human, this is going in there because it's just an odd story. It's very strange, and it should be of interest to people who are interested in this phenomenon. And that was one of them. I don't know if the guy ever actually saw him pick up a gun. He was shot at, and his hat was shot off. But I don't think he ever saw. He just assumed it was the wild man who had fired at him.
Mm.
I believe if it's the article I'm thinking of. So,
okay.
You know, maybe this was a human. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was a creature. But it was just such an odd account that I thought it deserved to go in there.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And it's the description of the creature when it comes into the house is what fascinated me. It's like it apparently walked into the house while they were like playing cards or whatever. And then, you know, he didn't even realize it was there until it like brushed the back of his neck.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, like you said, then it goes and like lays in his bed or something. It was very bizarre.
Yeah. And not if you're going to make up a story, that doesn't seem like the story you're going to make up.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like you'd make up something that you've heard similar stories of in the past.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I don't know how common it was for the community to share these wild man stories around. There is mention of one of the articles states that the Pennsylvania Dutch, who of course Pennsylvania Germans, do have an ongoing sort of fear of this, what they call the hairy man. So it must have been an element in their culture, but I'm not sure how much this stuff was passed around as far as folk tales and stuff.
Mm-hmm. One of the other stories, you have a wild woman who leaves the kids in a thicket. And again, with the missing 411 stuff, one of the patterns David noticed was, you know, the people would be found in thickets with scratches.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if the one that is, I mean, it's could come right out of one of the missing 411 books was the Florence Hughes case. If you want, I can go ahead and read that.
Yeah,
one.
Go ahead.
Okay, this is from July 21st, 1888. It was in the Bradford Era from Bradford, Pennsylvania. Lost or kidnapped. Mysterious disappearance of little Florence Hughes. Friday forenoon, Florence Hughes, the two-year-old daughter of John Hughes, an employee of the Bradford Oil Company, who lives on the Rutherford Farm, was playing in that vicinity with two other children. The little one's playmates left her alone while they were seeking flowers in a clump of underbrush nearby, and when they returned, she was gone. Mr. and Mrs. Hughes were immediately notified and instituted a rigorous search, but could find no trace of the missing one. All day long, the fruitless search was kept up. In the evening, a crowd started out from the city, swelling the number in the searching party to over 100. Every nook and spot in the woods and fields within a radius of 1 mile was examined closely, but without success. The lost babe could not be found. The parents are nearly distracted and have the keen sympathy of many friends in their trouble. It is believed the child has been kidnapped and stolen away. The Era, that's another newspaper, the Era contained an account of a supposed wild being a few days ago who has been seen in this locality of late, and it is now feared the loathsome wretch has spirited the child away to his lair in the hills. Major Adsit of the Bradford Oil Company ordered the men employed under his direction to prosecute the search until a clue was found somewhere. These, together with a large band of volunteer searchers, spent the night diligently seeking for the missing child. At a late hour, nothing had been heard from the missing one. Florence is a handsome child. She wore Friday a check gingham sailor suit. She has long brown curly hair, a round face, brown eyes, and rosy cheeks, and is stoutly built. Any information concerning her whereabouts will be joyfully received by the distracted parents. Then there's another article. There's two follow-ups. The first follow-up is no trace of the little one. Rutherford, Pennsylvania, July 20th. Florence, the little two-year-old child of John Hughes, who has been missing from home since 10 o'clock this morning, has not been found, although there were at least 200 men and boys with torches and lanterns scouring the woods all evening. So there the search has swelled to 200 people. So far, the search has been fruitless. It is thought that she may have been carried away by the wild man who has been seen by several in this locality recently. The parents are nearly frantic and earnestly request assistance to continue the search tomorrow morning. All who will kindly assist will please meet J.T. Jones at J.T. Jones Boiler House, Rutherford Farm, at 8 p.m. sharp. And then the final note is the search abandoned. A party consisting of J.P. Taylor, Thomas Mills, and two members of the Era staff visited the Rutherford District at 2 o'clock this morning and learned that no trace had been found of the lost child. A heavy fog hung over the woods, and the search was abandoned until daylight. So there's the bad weather rolling in, too, that he talks about.
Well, eventually.
Yeah, yeah.
Hmm. And then did you look to see if there was any other follow-ups on her?
I did. I did. I searched her name. I searched everything I could find, and that she seems to have gone missing.
Hmm. That's strange.
Yeah, I mean, and that could come right out of one of the missing 411 cases.
Oh,
I mean,
absolutely.
Every detail is there. It's just so strange.
Let's see, what else is there? You got a wide variation of descriptions. Like you said, you know, there's no Bigfoot at the time.
Right.
But the descriptions range all different sizes. Some of them are wearing clothes. Some of them are wearing tatters of clothes. Some of them seem like naked people. Some of them later on, of course, you got the gorillas and apes and things like that. I think you included one picture that was published in the paper that looks like a typical Bigfoot.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what happens if you think about people in the 1800s, they didn't have a name for something that stood up like a man and walked like a man and was covered in hair. So, you know, they didn't have Bigfoot, they didn't have Sasquatch, so just they didn't have a name in their vocabulary for it. So what do they call it? They think, well, it must be a wild man. That is until about right about 1890, when you start getting gorilla reports. All these wild man reports start shifting gradually. The wild man goes away, and then up through the 1900s, it becomes more or less all gorilla reports. And the reason for that is the discovery of the mountain gorilla, which most people, well, the West wasn't familiar with until the late 1800s in general, but most people didn't get to see a picture or anything until really the late 1800s, when they 1900 or so, when they started publishing pictures in newspapers. And they reported on gorillas in the paper as if they were sort of celebrities. Mm-hmm. They'd report their activities and, you know, oh, this gorilla, you know, smokes cigars and drinks beer, you know, and they'd report on them by name. There were only a few in the country, and they were very, very expensive. I saw a report at the time that in today's money, it would be something like $500,000 to $2 million, the equivalent. So the idea that there was a ton of escaped gorillas running around Pennsylvania is just, it's not possible.
Yeah.
They knew who had gorillas, they knew where they were, and they were reported on, you know, quite frequently. Now, what would happen here and there is these carnival sideshows would have a guy in a gorilla suit, and part of the act would be, or a supposed wild man, part of the act would be they would escape, and they would run around the carnival ground. Mm. And then you know, the keeper would catch them, you know, but that was part of the act. That was the whole thing. And these were just men in suits or, you know, or particularly hairy people that would act wild. But I think that's what got the notion of the escaped gorilla in people's heads, because it's mentioned again and again in these articles. Oh, this must be an escaped gorilla from, you know, a circus or a menagerie or something.
Yeah, especially in the early 1900s.
Yeah.
In fact, I think pretty much your whole last chapter is all gorilla.
Yeah, the 1920s, and it's really interesting. You can kind of trace the movement of these creatures, whatever they were, from late 1920 through 1921. They kind of moved from the center of the state out west a little bit, and then they come south into the Gettysburg area, and then across, and I believe into Maryland. The last gorilla, so-called gorilla report I have in the book is in the appendix, and it's in northern Maryland. So it looks like that you can sort of almost follow a path.
And it's really, in reading that last chapter is very fascinating because of the way that the newspapers go back and forth. You know, gorilla is a hoax. Oh, more gorilla sightings. You know, gorilla is a raccoon. More gorilla sightings.
Yeah. Yeah. After everyone says, you know, we've done it, we've solved it, then there's another sighting and it's the most ridiculous ideas that the raccoon is the example I use in the foreword, because it's the most ridiculous thing that anyone could mistake a raccoon for a 7 foot tall, you know, gorilla,
right,
or ape man is just absolutely crazy. But I think if one newspaper reported it and it was sensationalistic and it was selling papers, another newspaper thought, well, it's our job to you know, debunk that any way we can.
I noticed there seems to be, if you read the articles, a lot of back and forth between the newspapers insulting one another, but also on a political level too. You had like the Democrat and the Republican papers, you know, going back and forth about how the others are crazy.
Yeah, or this wild man must be they're going to sign him up to vote Democrat at the next election or something.
Right. Like yeah. So that infuting just kind of like was amusing to me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, including Bigfoot reports.
I'm trying to think of what I just had in my mind. Where did it go? All right. Let's look at some of the other notes I took here. There's when I was talking about the variation of descriptions, there's also some you've included that seem more like ghosts.
They mention them, and you find this. I haven't found this. I'm continuing my research. Like I said, when I originally wanted to do this book, I thought I was just going to do one book for the entire country. But I started turning up so many that it, you know, it became obvious I was going to be able to do more than one book. So I don't think I'm going to be able to do a book for every state, but I'm going to do, you know, different regions. I might have to, like, say, combine the Virginias or something like that.
Hmm.
But I'm going to continue. And what I found in Pennsylvania, which I haven't found too many other places, is they will call them spooks or ghosts. They'll call these creatures sometimes, where I don't find that too many other places.
Well, some of them sound like apparitions. You had one that was white-haired walking down the road.
Yes.
And that, although it did have some Bigfoot type of stuff going on there, it definitely sounded more apparitional.
And they call it a specter in that one. But it was screaming. It chased a fella home. They said they've been hearing screams at night. And the really interesting thing about that case is that was from 1907, that report. That's in an area where today we still get white Bigfoot reports.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's white Bigfoot reports in that general area. I mean, it's not, you know, a pin on the map, but in that general area of Western Pennsylvania, we still get white Bigfoot reports today.
Hmm. One of the common factors in all these reports are how quickly these things elude people.
Yes. Which is just common Bigfoot behavior. I mean, there are some attacks in the book. There's some really interesting, like pretty intense attacks where the creatures are breaking horses' necks with mm-hmm. one blow of the arm and things like that. But for the most part, when they're seen, they run away, which confirms with, you know, modern Bigfoot behavior. There are modern Bigfoot attacks as well, but you get things like window peeking, which you hear a lot of reports today about the creatures, you know, peeking in windows. You'll find window peeking in there. You'll find a lot of reports of the creatures attacking dogs, which you get today a lot. So that was really the more than the description of the creatures, which are all over the map. But again, modern Bigfoot report descriptions of the creatures are really all over the map. If you listen to the way people describe them, there, you know, some people say it looked like a chimpanzee. Some people say it looked like a man that was just hairy. Some people say it looked like a big gorilla. There's all kinds of descriptions of these things. So it's not the varying descriptions so much but the behavior that's so similar to these modern reports that really convinced me we're talking about the same thing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why this type of stuff is so valuable. The same with like when people go back, like Valet and Chris Auerbach went back and did the book collecting all the old UFO accounts pre-modern era. Because when you see that these things have been happening for a long time and they're the same thing, that's a useful piece of information. Today, you know, Bigfoot, UFOs, these things are so all over the place as far as the media goes and everything else. It's hard to tell the real things from the not real things, from the hoaxes right. or the people who are just hoping to see something and misidentifying something because of it.
Yeah, it's part of our pop culture now. I mean, yeah. UFOs, Bigfoot, the paranormal in general is really part of our popular culture. Back then, it wasn't. It really wasn't. These things were, you know, real oddities and very, very strange. I mean, they were worthy of being reported in newspapers to the attitude at the time was that, you know, it wasn't just, oh, John saw something. It was, you know, John saw something very specific and very hairy and possibly dangerous. So we're putting this in the paper.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, of course, the problem with any of this stuff is you don't know how many of these are the papers just looking to increase readership by printing strange stories?
Right.
You know, which is not too different from today. It's just on a bigger scale today with the internet.
Yeah. And had I more time, I could go track down some of the people in this. One of the stories I have in the book, because it's in an area that I'm doing a sort of long-term research on, and it's near enough to me where I can get there on a regular basis. I actually did the genealogy on the fellow mentioned in the article. I found his grave. The article mentions him coming home from church And he's buried at the church they mention. I found his gravestone. I found his wife's gravestone, who's mentioned in the article. So he was a real fellow, at least. And I traced the route back to probably where he lived. I found a road with his the same last name as him very nearby. I'm guessing that's where he lived. So, you know, as far as that goes, at least it was a real guy and a real place. You know, the names and the places were right.
Yeah.
Anything else? The other thing is, people didn't necessarily want to be, when they're named in there, people back then were made fun of too. So they didn't, for the same reason a lot of witnesses don't want to be named today, or won't come forward, you know, with a lie or a hoax story, because they'll just be made fun of. It applied back then as well. These people took a lot of grief. You know, like you said, they were accused of, you know, drinking or making up stories or you know, one thing or another, one way or another, just falsifying the story.
Yeah, yeah. And you can see that early on, as in the early part of the book, you get people just going, yes, and this person was crazy and reported this, and it's like, okay.
Yeah, and one of the Gettysburg newspaper in the 20s, it starts out saying, oh, we're getting these reports of a gorilla walking around the county. I don't know what people are drinking.
Yeah.
You know, in the northern part of the county. And then all of a sudden, when it comes, the creature starts being seen in Gettysburg proper, then the tone changes. It's like, okay, people we trust have seen this. So now it must be a real thing.
Yeah, I noticed that. That was pretty amusing. I think they were blaming, like, they were saying that it was a dry county and it must be all the Coca-Cola and stuff they were drinking.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that sounds about right. I mean, that's the typical way of ridiculing this stuff.
Yeah, until it hits somebody you trust, then you go, oh, wait a minute, maybe everybody's not crazy.
What do you remember what some of the other weird explanations were? I didn't write them all down.
Oh, they get gorillas, dogs are blamed, cows.
Oh, yeah?
I think they said it was a cow, which. Ironically, I have two modern reports of Bigfoot sightings in York County. One, I know the witness fairly well, and the police told him he saw a cow. He grew up on a farm. He said, I didn't see a cow. I know what a cow looks like. Not a cow. But the police told him, nope, you saw a cow. It was a cow. He told me I didn't see a cow. Another report, a guy, I don't know this witness, but I know the story. The fella supposedly hit one of the creatures with his car, and they told him that he hit a cow.
Well, yes, clearly you can't tell the difference between a cow and a large humanoid ape type creature.
Right. So again, this, you know, the drum beats on throughout time, you know, back then, oh, it was a cow, and here today, oh, it was a cow. Yeah.
And, you know, some of the reports talk about shooting them and it has no effect. Others say, you know, it fell down, but then it got back up like nothing, you know, like it wasn't really bothered, again, mimicking modern day Bigfoot reports.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the pretty intense attack at the Bolig farm where a boy shoots the creature. And this is some weeks before he's attacked, which, again, you get these reports of this now. Modern times about the creatures sort of following people home. And so the story starts where the boy and his sister are chopping wood by lantern light, and they see this thing, and they you know, I think they turn and run, go back to the house. And then they're out during the day and they see it in a cornfield, and he happens to have a rifle with him, and he shoots it, injures it. He says it dropped to the ground and rolled and then got up and, you know, took off running. And he and his father tracked it by the blood.
Yeah,
but couldn't find it. And I think it was a week after that, he was out at night chopping wood with his father, and they saw this creature. He ran and got the gun. The creature either recognized him or recognized the gun and attacked him and broke both his arms.
Oh, was it both his arms?
Well, it depends on the report you read.
Okay.
And they go, depending on whether they're trying to make the story less scary or more, you know, some had him in critical condition. Some had him with both his arms broken. Some had with one arm broken. Taking the sort of median of all the reports, I'd say he had at least an arm broken and he was knocked out, it appears.
Hmm. And I wish, you know, I wish they had better records back then where we could, like, say, look up a hospital record and see if this person was in the hospital with a broken arm.
Right. Yeah.
But that's just not going to happen.
No. But whatever the case, this creature or group of creatures, it was probably a group of creatures. I can't imagine there being one creature.
Assuming it's physical in the first place.
Right. Right. I believe this is my standard Bigfoot, my caveat that I say. I believe the creatures leave footprints. I believe they leave hair and scat behind. I believe they can bleed, although there are plenty of reports of them being shot and nothing at all happened. I just don't believe they're like any other natural animal, like a bear or a mountain gorilla or anything else. There's something very strange about them. So, you know, maybe physical creatures, maybe not. I believe there's a physical aspect to them at least.
Yeah, well, I would say the same thing with UFOs. I mean, even though I don't believe them to be physical craft, I think they do inhabit some element of physical space and can leave traces.
Yeah, yeah, and that's where this stuff gets truly weird.
Yeah.
I just find it hard to believe there's a breeding population of 8 foot tall ape men in North America, and we can't get a trail cam picture.
Right.
It doesn't make sense to me for a second. Every other animal, the most elusive animals, you can get trail cam pictures of. Cougars, you can get trail cam pictures of. You know, they're incredibly elusive, and you'll find trail cam pictures of them. A lot of them in places where they're not supposed to be, by the way. But you will not get Bigfoot on a trail cam. It's not going to happen.
Now, you also had some cases of it, like sucking the blood out of animals.
Yeah, chickens, I believe, you get a lot of that. And the one report said it killed 500 chickens, I don't believe at one time, but I think over the course of time.
Mm-hmm.
This creature was attacking these chicken farms. And again, that's something I found in modern Bigfoot reports too. In my first book, I have accounts of that in York County, the creature going into, you know, chicken houses and they'll find, you know, feathers and they'll find the headless bodies that appear to have the blood sucked out.
And you know what it makes me think of?
Chupacabra.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like is the chupacabra another version of Bigfoot, but just in a different location?
Or do these things just do the same thing in the same weird way that, you know, batteries are drained when you're around these things, or people have the nauseous effects sometimes, you know, not all the time. You know, it's there's a lot of these similar things that go across the paranormal spectrum.
They're very fond of chasing children. Now, is that a normal Bigfoot behavior?
All we have are witness accounts, when it comes down to it, other than footprints and, you know, some hair and scat. What we really have to base our ideas of these creatures and their behavior are witness accounts. And there are quite a few modern accounts of them, not necessarily chasing kids, but being, interested in them to the point of it being very concerning. You know, like people have kids and they'll be hanging around or they'll have a crying baby and these things will peek in the window and they'll mock the crying sounds or they'll do the crying sounds. In really scary cases, they'll learn the names of the kids and parents will say they'll hear their own voice calling the kids from the woods.
Huh. Okay, I've never heard those. That's pretty bizarre.
Yeah, there's some really creepy cases out there.
Huh. I wonder if that figures into the whole missing 411 thing as well.
Well, I have to admire David for not putting a pin on what he thinks it is. He never says he thinks it's Bigfoot, but he certainly describes things that sound like Bigfoot in more than one of his stories.
I think the thing is, if it's Bigfoot, then Bigfoot is not a typical animal. You know, like I don't see how the mimicking thing is going to be not the trait of a normal animal. you or I couldn't just go out and mimic someone's voice from the woods.
Right, exactly. And this all sounds like weird poltergeist activity as well, which we've talked about in the past too.
Yep, yep.
It just sounds, it's so bizarre when you get into that stuff. That's why I say, you know, whatever these things are, they're not, you can't tell me they're just another natural animal like a gorilla or a bear or something. I'm just not willing to believe it for a second.
Yeah, me neither. Let's see, what else do we have here? My favorite one. The thing that was bowing to trees with a box in its hand. And in some cases, it then runs and headbutts the tree. And in other cases, it just like makes some horrible cry and then disappears. I've never heard anything like that one before.
Yeah, and it almost reminded me, and they kept talking about it was doing this ritual. Like it was almost like it was, you know, worshiping at the trees or something. And I think in the early reports, it's a box, and then it comes back a few years later, and they're saying it's holding a bowl made of bark. And it would bow three times to the trees. And again, in their early reports, it would run head, you know, hard into it, they said, too, with its head, and then scream and disappear. I think in the later ones, it would bow three times, make a scream, and then disappear.
That is just so bizarre. And sometimes it was wearing clothes, too.
Yeah, and that's another thing with these reports. You get a lot of reports of these things either wearing clothes or tattered clothes. And could these be just regular humans? And yes, they could. But there's enough strangeness to the story that makes me think, well, you know, maybe not. And another thing is, this is during, you know, Victorian and Edwardian times. And I have a suspicion that sometimes certain editors or reporters might have throwing clothes on these things where the witness didn't necessarily say they had wearing clothes, just to sort of, you know, kind of a little bit more Puritan time. They might've thought a little racy to have naked men or women running around.
That makes sense. And something you don't see in modern Bigfoot accounts.
It's very, very rare. I think I've read one or two, and I used to hate those reports when I was a kid, because to me, it ruined the whole like image of Bigfoot. Like I read a report and that somebody, you know, was wearing like tattered pants or something. And I absolutely hated that. I wanted to throw that out the window. Now I think they're very interesting. When I hear those reports, I'm like, well, okay, something's really, really weird, because no one's going to report that if they want anybody to believe them, you know?
Right.
If they, at this point, if you just want to make up a Bigfoot story, you're going to, you know, describe a creature that looks like Patty or something. And you're not, tatters of clothes are not going to be part of the equation.
In some of the cases, they actually sound like werewolves more than Bigfoots.
Yeah, and Pennsylvania has a very strong werewolf tradition, to the point where I separated out a bunch of werewolf stories, which I'm holding on reserve for a werewolf book. So the fact that there are this many wild men and they didn't call them werewolves is actually pretty amazing to me, because my thought was, as I was saying before, you know, they didn't have a name for something that walked upright and was covered in hair. Well, they did, actually, and it was a werewolf. People from Germany and Switzerland, you know, a werewolf would have been part of their culture before they ever got to the New World. So I'm actually surprised you didn't get more of these things being called werewolves. But they're rare, where they're calling, you know, something a werewolf. Is much rarer than these wild man and gorilla reports.
There was one, I think the one that finally triggered it was one being at the door or something in ripped pants and semi covered in hair. And I'm thinking, it sounds like a werewolf. It sounds like someone who's turned into a wolf, not a Bigfoot report.
Right. Right. Yeah. And, there's a couple odd ones like that in there.
There's a bunch of weird assumptions too, but I think that's just human nature, where they just kind of jump to conclusions about what's going on.
Right. The one where the creature's, they're thinking he's saying Maggie must be calling for a woman named,
right,
you know, Maggie or Margaret or something.
Yeah, that's a great example. And they're treating it like fact. Oh, he's looking for his spurned lover. And it's like,
yeah,
okay.
There's a lot of wild men that are roaming the hills, that are looking for their wives. A lot of wild women that are crazy for one reason or another. Usually if it's a wild man, the general rule in these old articles, if it's a wild man, it's an escaped mental patient. If it's a wild woman, about 50% of the time she's escaped from a mental institution, and 50% of the time it's a witch. So you get that sort of a difference there when it comes to women.
Hmm. Well, that's not really surprising.
No,
there was one where they found a woman, an actual wild woman, living in a hut up somewhere.
Yeah, there's a couple, and again, there's mentions of the use of fire, which almost would immediately you'd think, well, that must be a human. But again, there were just these other odd things associated with it, where I believe one of them, they said the woman was 20 years old or something, but she'd outrun these hunters, you know. And threw these great big boulders down, scared these hunters out of the woods. So I believe my commentary in the book is something along the lines of, I want to meet this woman. You know, she's able to scare these experienced hunters out of the woods and throw big boulders down the hill. That she must have been something to see.
But I think you also point out that, you know, if this creature had taken a woman, it might have been the woman that they found that may have been held captive by this thing and not the thing that was throwing the boulders down at them.
Right, right. And like I said, they go for a lot of times for the easiest explanation. Oh, that must have been it. That's what people were seeing. You know, that's it. Story's over. You know, and the fun part is finding more stories after they say.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm wondering how many of them... Not only are maybe newspaper hoaxes just trying to get more readership, but some of them may have just been bored people having fun scaring other people.
It could have been. Yeah. And the newspaper hoaxes, I find it hard. Other than there's one particular writer, and I can't think of his name, where they call him out. And this guy apparently he was known for finding wacky, you know, crazy stories. Like two-headed, I believe the article mentions like he found a two-headed girl or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So other than him, which he it seems at least he had a history of this stuff. And again, even him though, he reports on these gorillas, I believe, and then they're calling him, oh, you know, it's another one of his stories. And then all of a sudden somebody else reports on it and there's, you know, and he comes back and says, see, I was right. You know, so who knows, but... But these are small town papers, so I don't know. You know, when you can follow the story from one town to another, like I said, in the 20s, where these things just kind of move across the state.
Yeah.
It seems less like a newspaper hoax, but again, yeah, I wasn't there, and it's, you know, these people are all dead now. Can't check my sources.
Right. Well, yeah, obviously. There's one article in particular, I think it's mentioned in a few, where the thing literally just destroyed bear traps.
Yeah, ripped them up.
Yeah.
Tore the bait out of it. And they said they had it chained to or tied to a tree or locked to a tree with some big cable. Snapped the cable like it was thread. They found the traps, 100 yards away or whatever it was. And then they go on to say that they've solved it. It was a dog.
Yes. Yeah.
So,
well, what was a raccoon too?
It was a raccoon. It was a dog. A dog that could, you know, was as big as a racehorse and ran faster than a racehorse. And I mean, I think in a few of the stories, the police, we'll have solved it, and they'll go to the papers and say, I've caught a big Newfoundland dog. This is what people were seeing. And I half wonder if that wasn't to calm people down. You know, maybe people were getting a little stirred up and the police just wanted to calm everybody down and say, okay, we solved it. It was this big Newfoundland dog, you know, yeah. Story's over.
Well, these people are crazy. Let's kill the hysteria by, you know, showing them that these reports are crazy.
Right. Yeah.
There is, what was the other thing I had written down here? Oh, the strange dog deaths. There was one where a bunch of dogs were killed.
There's quite a few where dogs get attacked by these creatures. And again, this is echoed today.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, you know, these creatures don't like dogs. And that's why a lot of people talk about, you know, what's dogs good to take out Bigfooting. If you love the dog, no dog is good to take out Bigfooting because if the reports are accurate, and again, we only have you know, reports to base the behavior on, what witnesses have seen. But if they're accurate, these things do not like dogs. So I wouldn't take a dog out Bigfooting if I loved the animal. Yeah, this is, I have an article from the Harrisburg Telegraph, 1881. A monster gorilla is reported to have made its appearance on Jimmy Brunt's farm, Valley Township, Armstrong County. The other night, the animal visited the house of John Emery and captured a dog, which he carried away into the woods. Subsequently, it is said the animal attacked and badly wounded a gigantic hound belonging to Mr. Con Knowlton. A party is organizing to effect its capture. So, and there's report after report like that where it's just they're killing and attacking dogs.
Well, I think there was one where they killed it in its pen, the dog's in the pen or something, and there were like dog skulls laying around that looked like they'd been gnawed on.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's later on. Yeah, that's actually right across the river from me. Yeah, in Marietta, that one. And they weren't sure what it was. You know, there had been wild man reports in the area. No one saw it happen. But, you know, they suspect that, you know, what else could it have been, kind of thing. Like, I think it pulled the skulls apart.
Yeah, yeah. Now, in the appendices, you have a section on mystery lights and other strange creatures. Tell people a little bit about those.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. My thing with Bigfoot is, if you're going to be open about the reports, and again, our witness reports are our best evidence, I feel. Yeah, footprints are great. Hair is great. But as far as the behavior of the creatures, witness reports are our best evidence. Our only evidence, really. And what you get a lot of is mystery lights. Sometimes UFOs, sometimes orbs. You know, sometimes will-o'-wisp types things. And these will be in conjunction with Bigfoot reports, either by the same witness or by another witness, but in the same area at the same time. Is Bigfoot riding in a UFO? I don't think so.
Well, I don't think so if you're talking about it as a craft, but however, whatever's allowing these things to appear may also be allowing these lights to appear. It may be side effects of the same thing.
Exactly. Exactly. Or whatever area these things are drawn to, the lights are also drawn to.
Right.
Whatever the case, they're seen often enough in the same place around the same time where I think it's disingenuous to not at least note the fact that these things happen, you know, around the same time in the same place. So I thought, well, as I'm going through, if I see any reports of mystery lights, I'll just pull them aside as well. So these are just reports I happened to run across while I was looking for the wild man and Bigfoot reports.
Now, what about the other creatures?
Same thing. As I was doing searches, sometimes I'd find, you know, just reports of weird creatures. There's a lot of like river monster kind of reports, like big serpents and things like that. But there's some really odd stuff like fish that walked upright like humans, like right out of the Susquehanna River. This fish that walked upright like a man kind of walked out, and just some odd reports like that. And I thought, well, since I'm doing the research anyway, I'll just throw these in an appendix in the back. I think anybody who's interested in Bigfoot would probably be interested in these as well.
Okay. Well, I have to say, this is a fascinating book, and it you've done a great job of collecting these stories. And like I said, this stuff to me is very valuable. Whereas today's Bigfoot reports are so tempered by the pop culture interpretations and stuff like that, that you don't have that in these books, in these accounts, I mean, that you've put in this book. And that makes it, and it's really interesting that you see the same patterns with slightly different descriptions, but the behaviors and stuff are so similar.
Yeah, that to me was the censure. It was, I really think we're talking about the same thing. Can I be 100% sure? No, but it sure sounds like it.
And you even have the one drawing that looks like a modern day Bigfoot.
Yeah. Yeah. There was two illustrations from the time. One just kind of looks more like a hairy man they put in a tree, like a, you know, just a, looks like a human with hair all over him. But the other really looks like a modern, and I believe the caption is something like the ape man that terrorized the county or something.
What where can people get the book?
You can get it on Amazon, and it's now available. Just came out this week as an ebook. So if people prefer an ebook, you can get it as an ebook, or they can get it in the old fashioned hard copy as well. You can get it from Amazon or directly from me.
And how do they get to you?
The best place to find me is strangefamiliars.com. There should be links to everything from my podcast to me and et cetera, all there. So.
Okay. And your band and everything else.
Everything should be there.
And it's a great series you're doing with the Strange Familiars too.
Oh, thank you.
I am very happy that we're helping you distribute through Where Did the Road Go?
I'm happy to be with you. It's great fun doing that.
All right. Thank you so much, Tim.
Thanks for having me back.
And to take you out tonight, we're going to hear something from Timothy Renner's primary band, Stone Breath. This is a track called Apples for the Albatwitch, since it's what we kind of started talking on pretty early on this interview. It comes off his CD Cryptids, which is, if not his most recent, one of his most recent. And you can find him on Bandcamp or just go to the Strange Familiar site or darkhollerarts.com, I think is the other way to find stuff from him. See you next time.
Thank you.